Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is Dara Lynn Evans. I'm joined today with my co-host Molly Martin and James Stiegel. We're talking with fantasy author Miko Azul. Miko wrote her first book in second grade, proudly scribbling the cover with crayons and binding it with yarn. She's always pursued knowledge of magic, secret societies, the occult, science, and spirituality. As an adult, her tastes have broadened to include historical fiction and adventure action. These influences can be found in her epic fantasies. She was raised in the Pacific Northwest and has traveled broadly and served in the United States Marine Corps. And now she's into scuba diving, hiking, and kung fu. Her debut novel, Ascari, won a Moonbeam Children's Book Award and took first place at the San Francisco Writers Conference. She lives on the shores of Puget Sound with her three sons, and she's in our studios today. Miko, congratulations on your first novel. How exciting.
Thank you very much.
It's not your first novel, is it? It's actually your second novel. It's your new series, The Staff of Fire and Bone, which just came out from Not a Pipe Publishing at the end of January.
Yes.
Great. So do you want to talk to us today about your writing journey?
My writing journey, like you mentioned, started when I was very young. I have always had a love of books. Gertrude Chandler Warner's Boxcar Children was my first love. And once I was hooked, I wanted to create my own stories. And my first story that bound in construction paper was a story about a little mouse who had lost its cheese. And as an adult, I came across a book that says, "Where's my cheese?" or something to that effect. I thought, this is great. But I didn't really start writing in earnest until late 30s when I was home with two children under two and needed something to do to give myself a little emotional and intellectual stimulation. So I started building a world that I could go to when I wasn't changing diapers, cleaning vomit, that kind of thing. So that's where the world building started, was just to find a place in my head to go. And it took off. I have been working the world for about 10 years now. And it's blossomed into a wonderful story. And once the first manuscript was completed, I decided that the San Francisco Writers Conference then would be the next logical step. And that conference is amazing for first-time writers, you know, because as writers, we work in a vacuum. We don't really have any gauge for how we are if we're a first-time writer. And these huge conferences offer community and camaraderie and the opportunity to speed date with agents, which is both exciting and terrifying, because as every new writer wonders, what if I suck? You know, mom thinks I'm brilliant, but what if everybody else thinks I suck? So we always go into something like that as a first-time, a little trepidation, a little, you know, angst building. But it was a great experience. Like you mentioned, I did win first place in the writing competition, which gave me the opportunity to publish that first manuscript, Ascari. And that was wonderful, but it was almost 900 pages. So it really wasn't picked up. wasn't picked up commercially just because it was so expensive to self-publish. But I did learn a lot about self-publishing. Mainly what I learned was that it was a lot of hard work. So I knew I had something to do. I had to work something out to shorten that. And I had the opportunity then, from connections made at the Writers Conference, to go down and work for a weekend at the Writers Guild of America West. They had a Veterans Writing Weekend, and I had the opportunity to work with two amazing screenwriters, Ashley Edward Miller, who wrote Thor, and Phil Bowman, who penned the Scary Movies. So it was an interesting combination. But that's really, that work with them really honed my skill, took my writing to the next level. And so I promptly came home full of excitement and chopped my book up into tiny little pieces and started again, which was like chopping off your child's right arm. But it made a much better book. So it's now only 474 pages, much tighter, much faster, neat, clean, you know, good pace, and not all the extraneous verbiage that really, debut writers are so often, you know, prone to fill with that isn't necessarily essential to the story. So that's where we are. And this is where I am with it.
Awesome. So am I hearing that right? For some reason, it wasn't occurring to me until you just said it, that Ascari, the debut novel, that's the world that they're in, right? For the Staff of Fire and Bone?
Yes. The world is called Moralia. But the first edition of this world building story was called Ascari. The Ascari are the main people.
Okay.
And it also means, you know, warrior in Arabic. So that was, I wanted that to be the first name, but an you know, an odd named book by an unknown author with a really weird name probably wasn't commercially feasible. So we decided to go with something a little more mainstream.
Yeah. The Staff of Fire Mode does seem to fit that category of an epic fantasy little more effectively.
Yeah,
when we're looking for it on the shelf. Cool. Oh, okay. So you've taken Ascari and broken it up into a couple of books and really honed it, is what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From your experience at the conference and that workshop. Oh, wow. That is so cool. Awesome. Well, before we go any further talking about it, I would love to hear a little bit from you reading from Staff of Fire and Bone, which is the new book.
All right. I will introduce my secondary character, Raisha, and this is the beginning of chapter 2. The wind blew Raisha's long silver hair back behind her like a streaming banner, her eyes blurred with tears. She blinked to clear them and ducked her head down closer to her mount's thick, feathered neck as he soared high over the Janae forest, the green canopy deceptively peaceful blur beneath them. Raisha's blood thundered through her veins with the thrill of riding this magnificent beast, especially as it hunted. The Lanier folded its broad wings and dove faster as he neared the flock of Kasseri flying low above the trees in the forest. The golden raptor's wingspan exceeded 40 feet, one of the largest Laniers in her wing. His dive called Raisha's eyes to sting from the biting air. Screeching his hunting cry, the enormous raptor extended his talons and grasped a juicy young fowl from the flock as it scattered in panic. Raisha felt the exultation of the successful hunt and steered him down to the valley floor where she could dismount and allow her beast to eat its prey in peace while she sought her own meal. "Well done, Yongayan," she said softly and stroked the beast's powerful shoulder once she'd slid down. She quickly braided her long silver hair and shoved it under her green cap for camouflage. The Lanier regarded his rider with amber eyes and then bent his head to his prey. The beast turned its head sideways to hear if anything other than its rider approached, and satisfied that they were alone, the enormous beast tore through the downy blue feathers of the Kasseri's belly and ripped into the steaming flesh with his curved beak. The Sumeri warrior watched the noble beast with pride. Her heart raced with the fierceness at which it rendered the flesh from bone. To be partnered with this regal animal was the culmination of many years of hard training and had been the crowning achievement in her family's long line of Sumeri warriors. No Angersoll had ever been accepted into the elite Lanier wings, which made Raisha uniquely qualified for her current mission. This quick foray for food was the only delay she would allow herself in her mount. Raisha ran smoothly into the trees, her lithe body accustomed to long hours of hunting and tracking. She disappeared from sight, the foliage tattoos covering her body blending perfectly with the underbrush of the forest. Raisha moved silently, her aquamarine eyes scanning the ground for movement of grubs or for any plants that she could eat. She readily found the climbing jicama vine and cut off the tuber bigger than her hand. Slicing off the fibrous rind with her long hunting knife, she bit into the white flesh, wiping its sweet juices from her chin. Closing her eyes, Raisha began the ritual of gratitude that had been taught to the Shaili people by Lady Morelia and her daughters when the Shaili were first created, a ritual carried on by the Sumeri despite the abandonment of the deities. Raisha pricked her finger with the tip of her blade and let a drop of blood fall to the vine where she'd cut off the jicama, finishing the prayer. The ruby drop sparkled like a jewel and absorbed into the vine. This offering would speed the healing of the severed plant and allow the nourishment it would need to bear more fruit.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to hear an author read and really get your voice as we're listening. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right. So as we had talked about earlier, our focus this year is on the podcast is on world building. And we have a lot of questions about the contents, but when I first opened your book, it begins with a map that is, you know, the rival of any Tolkien book. And I was just listening to a podcast recently. Brandon Sanderson was talking about his obsession with maps at the front. And I think a lot of us who read fantasy are obsessed with those maps. Would you talk about that a little bit? Is that where you started with this, or did that?
It really is. Yeah, I started with world building, which initially began with the creation mythology, right? So how did this world come to be? Who created it? How do the people recognize their place in it? So I had to create something that made sense to me. So I created a world. It wasn't unlike Tolkien's like creation mythology, where he goes back well before Middle Earth. So the deities created this world. This particular world is, I can't remember the name of the type of world building it is, but the deities lived in the, you know, heavens, and there was a war and there was a bad guy. And in order to contain this bad guy, the wife deity had to create herself into the earth type place where they live. The father figure then becomes their son, their daughters then are the three moons. And so this is the creation mythology that I have running kind of throughout the background. So this is how the world came to be. And then we started with the different lands. Okay, so what kind of land would I like to live in? I'd like to live in a jungle. Well, what does that look like? What kind of plants grow there? What kind of animals would grow there? What would they eat? You know, what kinds of things would they grow, and what kinds of meals would they produce, and what kind of wine could they brew, or beer, or whatever? So it was really a lot of that. So I have a forest, I have a jungle, I have a desert area, I have a mountainous area, kind of like where we live here in the Pacific Northwest. So I tried to pick all of those different areas because I had some interest in learning about them or experience in living in them. And then we just went on from there.
Awesome. What I love that comes out of that, one of the things that interests me the most about the book is how multicultural it is, and these distinct magics and cultures and affinities, and based on their lands and where they're coming from, but also that it's coming out of that deep mythology. So I appreciate mm-hmm. that you talked about that. But even more that it's kind of a reflection of our world today in terms of, you know, the multicultural interests, the prejudices among the different groups, and how isolated some of them are in their desire for purity and whatnot. Did any of today's issues influence what you were doing, or how did you bring those issues in?
Of course. Of course it did. Racial discrimination is a huge issue for me, and I can't really explain why, other than I have a child who is blonde haired, green eyed, beautiful, tall, looks elven, right? One of those kinds of people. And on the other hand, I married somebody who was dark. And so there was this contrast in my own family between, you know, the blended family where the light side was discriminated against and the shorter, darker, heavier, stouter people were more embraced because that was the current dynamic of my family. But broader than that, this is a huge issue in our culture. And I thought, you know, the initial spark was there looking at the way my ex-husband treated the two different sides of children that we had. And I looked at the broader issue internationally and I thought, you know, this is a bigger deal than that. And so there is this underlying theme of racial discrimination and how, you know, it really is the uniqueness of each individual that makes them special. And it doesn't really matter what color they are, where they come from. The discrimination piece is really irrelevant, and you end up harming yourself or your culture or your society, or in this case, your entire world, because you don't have an open mind and you don't want to see these kinds of things. And it's, I hope that the novel isn't incredibly preachy, but there is that underlying theme.
Oh, no, I don't think it is at all. In fact, I guess that's one of the things that for, especially as a young adult novel, that these issues are embedded in there, but they're not preachy. They feel really natural as the characters are dealing with the different cultures and the prejudices, and our main character, Cedrin, who is effectively mixed race. He is, mm-hmm. He's a mix of all of the races here, but he's recognized as human and demon. And so I thought that was really effective to make him the point of view character, because then we were really empathizing with the struggles, and he really brings out all of these prejudices. We can see how they affect the individual. So I thought that was great. So a lot of empathy for him. Go ahead.
To pile on, if I may, the secondary character of Raisha, I thought it was really interesting to get her point of view as well, because she comes from a culture that is sort of very obsessed with this idea that we are better and we are pure and we shouldn't mix with the, you know, the lesser peoples. And then she completely abandons that point of, you know, that sort of worldview, and begins to recognize, you know, like what you were talking about, that an individual's value is based on that individual, not on what race they come from.
I'm really glad you guys get that, because, you know, this is my first big release, and so I never know if anybody's really going to see that or understand that that's my goal, and so I'm really thrilled that you guys picked that in, and I picked it up and got it, and are questioning you about it. That's great.
So I guess along those same lines, with writing for young adults, how do you balance that need to, like, this isn't an issue book per se. I mean, you're not being preachy, but these issues are in there as Cedrin is and others are working to save the world. How do you balance that, like, telling a story that young adults are going to want to read, that, you know, is reflecting their interests in their world, and having what is a very rich and deep story. It isn't just a fluffy, let's go ride some dragons, or let's go, you know, frolic off in the forest. I think that it's doing a lot of good work, and, you know, to tell a really good story, but also to our young readers are going to embrace, but at the same time, like telling a real story that is going to be meaningful. As at the same time, how do you do that?
That was accidental. When Twilight first came out, that was such a huge explosion in the fantasy world, and so much of the young adult market has since then become this paranormal romance thing. And I have three boys, so finding something for them to read in the young adult section was really difficult. So I decided, after reading Aragon and thinking, you know, if a 15-year-old kid can do it, I might give it a try. So I really wrote something that I would like to read, and something that I thought my boys, being action adventure lovers, would get into. And so a lot of it was, like I said, some subconscious. I put a lot of the discrimination stuff subconsciously in there at first, because this was what I was experiencing, and I really wanted to say, this is right, knock it off, you know, that kind of thing. And as it progressed, you know, the more I read things like Clive Cussler, and, you know, anything with a real action adventure twist to it, I tried to put those elements into the story. But ultimately, for young adult readers, and any readers really, this book is for those people who don't recognize their own value. I want everybody to read this book and get that you're all a hero in your own way, and you just need to recognize your uniqueness and, you know, take charge of your own reality, make your own decisions. Because even in Cedrin's life, there's a prophecy that says you must do X, Y, and Z. And he's like, yeah, maybe I will and maybe I won't, right? You know, so he gets to make these choices irregardless of a prophecy or what people's expectations are. And that's really what I hope young readers get, is we all have these desires and the abilities to make decisions and make our intentions our life, because that's what we really have control over. So that's kind of what I focused on wanting to portray, and all the other stuff just kind of fell in naturally as I progressed the story.
Excellent. I'll just say one more thing about, in particular, writing for young adults, and then maybe I'll let Molly have a few, have her say. One of my big pet peeves in YA literature is that trope of having adults who are the enemy or who are morons and idiots, and it's only the young kids who can save the day. And so one of the other things I really appreciate is in your novel is the multiple point of view characters that we have, who are both young and older generation perspectives, mm-hmm. and adults who are effective and who are working to help, and who are working with our young protagonists, but who are also flawed. They're not perfect. They're not just Gandalf in there. They have some flaws as well. And then we do have our, you know, the evil uncle who is our enemy. So I think you've captured that, the roller coaster of being young, but not falling into that trap of all adults suck, or, you know, being able to show both sides of that so that young readers will go, oh, okay, maybe those adults have a point. I guess my question would be, how are you balancing, like, having those young protagonists, you know, who are smart but also who need the adults, and bringing in adults to work with them?
Well, really, I was a student of Joseph Campbell's The Hero of a Thousand Faces. And so following the hero's journey, you have certain archetypes that make a story more effective. And regardless of how the story is told, people across all cultures will recognize the young hero. People will recognize the wizard, or the sage, or the healing woman. And so I really gravitated, since I am an older person, I'm 50. So, you know, I had to have a couple of old guys in there who knew something. So I gave him an older character that was a mentor type, but again, like you said, very flawed. You know, he really struggles with what his role is. Is it to save Cedrin, or is it to kill Cedrin? So he really struggles with who he is and what his role is. And, you know, so I tried to balance young people and old people, just because this isn't just a YA novel. I really hope that bookstores put it into the fantasy section, because, you know, boys don't necessarily go to the YA section. They'll go to the fantasy section. And this is a book that I think even adults will enjoy. It's sophisticated enough that I think it will keep people engaged without any gratuitous sex or violence, just, you know, despite that fact. And so that's why I did put older people in there. So I would have folks that would, you know, have people to identify with and to root for, because like you said, it's not just some kid saved the world and all the adults suck. You know, that wasn't appropriate. I wanted, because life isn't like that. There's adults who are really awesome and there's kids that are really not. So life is full of all kinds of characters of all different ages, backgrounds, and opportunities.
Great. Oh, did you want to talk about some language things?
I do. I have a couple. I have probably more questions than is reasonable, so we'll just try to limit them to the ones that we can get to. So one of the things that your blog mentioned is that you are interested in studying languages and that you've traveled extensively. You mentioned that the original title, Iskiri, was an Arabic word. Mm-hmm. And then just the names of the characters themselves, you know, there's a lot of symbols and markings that we as English speakers may not be used to seeing. So how did your influences, you know, your interests and influences in terms of languages, in terms of terminology, and in terms of names, how did that influence your world building process?
Like most fantasy writers, I am a Tolkien-based person, right? We all come from that basic format. But what I found as I worked was the Norse or Celtic or Gallic or Germanic base, and I speak German, French, and some, when I lived in Europe, I actually took Latin in school. They still teach that over there. So I have this Germanic and Romance base of language, but the Germanic and the Norse and the Celtic have been done so much and so well that I really wanted to try and do something a little bit different. So I grabbed an Arabic English dictionary and a Chinese English dictionary, and I looked for sounds. You know, I first would look for words that meant what I wanted them to mean, and then I manipulated them to get a specific kind of sound, right? Because I didn't want that harsh German or Norse sounding kind of thing. And then once Not a Pipe Publishing picked up this novel, I worked with some editors who said, wow, you know, your sounds are really great, but all the words kind of are homogenous. You know, they all kind of look the same, sound the same. So let's make each people and distinct area have their own distinct characteristics. So people from the land of Askari by, all of the Askari names have an accent grave on the second syllable. All of the folks from Shamshaili, the Shaili people, all of the folks there and all the names from there have the A umlaut E combination so that everything sounds like an A. You know, there's that A sound. The Meccan people have a apostrophe in between the words to give it that glottal stop. So Meccan, and some folks from the Yezmin part of the world, they have the Z, you know, a soft Z in all of their words. And then the fifth and final main area is the Molinark. And so there's a hard K with all of the sounds and names from Molinark. So if you're looking at a fantasy book, and fantasy is so difficult for a lot of people, if they're not used to weird names and sounding and structures, it's really hard. And I had a lot of people tell me that with my original book, I can't get past your names. So looking at these names, regardless of how they're pronounced, somebody will look at a name with an accent and go, okay, I know where that person's from on the map. They're from this part. And if I see a Z walking on there, I know they're from this part of the map. Or so they recognize initially, and where's this person coming from? You know, and then they know what they know about them based on how we've built up who's from where and what their beliefs are. So I wanted there to be both a instant visual reference to that, because it makes it easier. Even if you can't pronounce it in your head, at least you can say, okay, well, this kind of, I know who these people are. And I hope that makes it a little easier for new fantasy readers.
Yeah, that actually segues beautifully into my next question, which was going to be, do you think authors should include a pronunciation guide? And then why or why not?
I don't, because every person has their own voice in their own head, and they're going to read it any way they're going to. And if I was a fan of Terry Brooks' Shannara series forever, right? But to me, it was the sort of Shannara. It was always Shannara. And then I met Terry Brooks, and he's like, yeah, my Shannara books. And I thought, no, I screwed that one up, you know, right? or, you know, Harry Potter's Hermione. For me, it was Hermione until the first movie came out. I thought, oh, wow, I got that. So it really doesn't matter. I don't necessarily think that people have to have a pronunciation guide, because it doesn't matter. They're gonna read it the way they read it, and that's what's important. I don't want them to get hung up on how to pronounce this name. I want them to get sucked into that story and never look back.
So when the audiobook comes out, then that'll kind of be the definitive version, I guess.
Yes, and if I can get Davina Porter to narrate that, that'd be awesome. I'm not going to hold my breath.
Oh, you already have a voice actress picked out. I love it.
She's amazing.
You had mentioned earlier that you had help in creating a little bit more differentiation between the languages. And I know that Tolkien was really famous for really going way, way back and talking about what is the language and then how did it evolve from there.
Right.
Some readers do find that this bogs them down, having to deal with too much non-standard English. So in dealing with these different languages and these different cultures, how much of that did you find that you had sort of instinctively couched in a way that would be easy for English speakers to read? And how much of it was your editors kind of gently nudging you in that direction? And then how much of it was you maybe not taking their suggestions and saying, no, this is my vision. This is just the way it's going to be.
Well, I really did not want to create a language. I've studied linguistics and I've spoken different languages, but I don't have the skill to effectively and incredibly create a whole language. So I just went with the sounds that sounded unique and sounded different without being so strange. And it worked out well. I mean, I didn't want to do anything too different. There are some things that I have to describe because you won't know what they are. They're a strange word, like ferroch. A ferroch is a chicken, essentially, somebody who's a coward, right? But I have to describe that because you don't know what a ferroch is. I had to come up with a swear word. But again, I didn't want it to be offensive to anyone. So I made up, Mizaki or Majaku or I call it Mizaki piles. And my editor changed the name. So this is one where in my mind it's still Mizaki, right? So it's Majaki piles. And this is essentially goat droppings, mm-hmm. right? They're an ovid type of critter in the world. So it was little things like that where I capitulated and said, okay, I get the whole make these things visually distinct. I capitulated probably too much because, again, I'm still struggling with recognizing the new names of everything in my book. And so I'll screw that up. But I really wanted it to be something that wasn't going to be so difficult for people to get because really trying to read Elvish, that really does bog down a lot. And I didn't want readers to look at passages of text that you couldn't really interpret unless you went to the end, the annex in the back and spent 6 months working on it. That's just not my thing. That's not what I do well. So I didn't want to try.
Well, and I thought that you're actually the passage that you read at the beginning of the interview was a very good example of this because we're introduced to a lot of character names and items or things in the world that we have no reference for, but because we're introduced to them in concept and we can see how they interact with the character, then we can get some idea that, I might not know exactly what this creature looks like, but I know it's some kind of big bird that a person can ride on.
Right.
So I've got something that I can picture in my head, and I may not know what all of these fruits and vegetables and jungle looks like, but I've got a taste and I've got some sensory input. Mm-hmm. So I thought that you did a really good job of giving us a lot of details and clues for something that we might not necessarily, instead of just having to look it up in some kind of entry in the back, like you said.
Right.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your process for creating the book. You already mentioned that you had written it as the big behemoth doorstopper and then had the opportunity to work with some folks and pare it down a little bit. Or break it up, it sounds like. Is that right?
No, I actually pared it down and scrapped everything that I didn't use, and I started a whole different book for the next book. There's a whole, he goes in a whole different direction. So.
Oh, okay.
I just took out the junk that you didn't need.
Awesome. Okay. Well, so the first one that you wrote as the doorstopper was really this book, and you've taken stuff out. So how have you gone forward with how are you going forward with this series? Since did you originally plan it to be a huge long series, or how has that evolved since you made those kind of drastic changes to what it was originally?
One of the main things that I learned working with the Writers Guild was that each book needs to stand alone because people might not have access to each book. So Askari, the first version of this was a cliffhanger. It was it didn't have a solid ending. And that was, again, one of those amateur mistakes that first time writers make, thinking that this was kind of a cool thing and you leave it hanging on the edge and then it takes you 10 years to get the next one done and people are mad. So, so each book had to be standalone. So I cut out a lot of it and made it a standalone book, gave it a complete arc with an ending that made sense, but left you knowing that there's more to come with this story. The story's not over, but there is that satisfactory ending to it. And so in this first story, Cedrin learns about who he is and he has to come to grips with what he's expected to do. And he gets enough confidence to move forward and have a couple of small successes. The big challenge is still at the end. I mean, he's not anywhere near ready for that. So the next one takes him in a different direction. He has to traverse the entire land of Morelia and pick out things from each of the different peoples. And so he's engaging with a whole different area in the next book and dealing with those issues as he makes challenges and successes forward and has some pitfalls and goes backwards. But the final book, I plan there to be three in this particular series, in this particular storyline that I'm developing. I've already written a prequel, which is complete, about, you know, the story of how Cedrin came to be, how his parents met and all of that kind of thing, and how he actually came to exist. But that was just an exercise in, let's see if I can actually write a novel that's less than 10 million words. So I imagine this will be a solid three stories that I have outlined, three book series, and then the smaller prequel. And then I'm going to stay in Morelia, but I don't think I'll follow the same character lines. There's so many cool characters that I get to play with that I'd like to go in different directions and explore different peoples and their experiences.
It does seem like you've set the world up to be able to do that with, you know, as you were talking about earlier, that deeper mythology and probably the time periods, because there's a whole interesting thing that is set up in this book about the gods abandon us and several 100 years before. So you've got all kinds of fun things to play with there. It's very clever. How long did it take you to write that first version, Ascaria? And then how long from when you decided to change it and make it into this new trilogy? Like, what did that look like?
It took a couple, 3 years to do the first one. But again, most of that is world building. And, you know, I'm home with two kids under two. And then once they got a little older, I work full time. So I've got three kids, full-time job, and I'm a single mom, so there's a lot going on. So, you know, we do what we have to, right? Because one thing I don't do is television. I watch zero television, with the exception of Downton Abbey. I don't watch any television at all. And so this is what I do in my free time. I'm always working on something, and if an idea strikes me, then I'm working on it. So it takes about 2.5 years with all of life getting in the way to actually get through this. And that's not too bad, I guess. Of course, every writer wants to be able to work on it full time, but I doubt that that'll happen because most of us, even if we're full-time writers, we still have all these other familial obligations and things to do. So probably a couple years, but that's reasonable for a 500-page book.
I think that's super fast for a 500-page book. Based on personal experience.
Right.
How do you balance, like, how do you balance that life? When do you get to write? What is your process for all of that?
I have one talent that I'm super proud of that I never had as a kid, but my time in the Marine Corps gave me this really great honed talent of time management. And I am super disciplined. So every Wednesday night I do laundry, and every Friday night I do, you know, clean the bathroom. And so I keep a small house. I don't have a big house, you know, so every day is regimented, and there's this pretty regular schedule of, you know, what I do and when I write. My children, as teenagers now, are nocturnal. So on Friday and Saturday nights, they stay up late and play video games. And so I have Saturday and Sunday mornings to myself to write. And that's when I do most of my writing. And I work in a wonderful job that is about an hour from my home. So I have all this time commuting where I'm thinking, where am I going with the story next weekend? What do I want to work on? Where am I headed? So I've got 5 days of thought process, writing down notes, you know, this kind of thing, so that when Saturday and Sunday come, I'm ready to rock, right? This is boom, I'm ready to write it, and I can get a chapter or two in a weekend, which is pretty good. Not always like that, but that's a pretty successful way of doing it.
That's awesome. We just spoke with Jeff Wheeler recently, and he talked about a similar process for his first several novels, where he worked and has a big family, so he would think about it all week, and then he had a very set time that he would work. So that sounds like an excellent model.
I actually have a couple questions. One of the things that we were talking about earlier that I'd like to go back to is, Darylynn, you had mentioned we're in a world, we exist, where the gods have either left or they've abandoned us. And Miko, you had also mentioned that you did a lot of sort of preliminary world building of what is the creation myth of this world? You know, where do the people believe that the gods and goddesses came from? And it seems that in this world, the gods and the goddesses, the divine, if you will, seems much more concretely real to people. Like, they truly believe it's not just one of those things that's maybe up for discussion. Some people kind of don't believe it. It's just everybody is in on this. And so from practical purpose, I was thinking, how does this influence the everyday culture? If you truly believe, like, not only does the goddess exist, but I'm walking on her physical form right now every time I walk across the street. And then sort of the follow-on question was, is this belief practiced differently in each culture?
Okay, so that is one common theme across all of the cultures. No, everybody believes this, and it's consistent among everybody because I just am not smart enough to make it different. So the deities in this particular series of books are very real, concrete people because largely I didn't want to get into the religious debate, right? I didn't want to have anybody think that I was killing God or creating God or whatever. I just didn't want to go there. So I made my deities and I gave them a history, and they're more like Greek gods where they have personality and they have distinct traits and they have a distinct history. And they're very real hands-on deities that are more powerful creators. But again, they have removed themselves for a reason. Without busting the story wide open, there's a reason they've abandoned these people. They're fed up with them, and they've done something horrible to the world. And now they have to deal with the consequence of, now the deities are not going to help you anymore. However, as you get through the story, sometimes they start to come back because they realize we need to get involved here. We need to physically aid this quest or all of us will be destroyed. So now I made them concrete, real people, if you will, for that reason. I just didn't want to go into the religious debate at all.
Yeah, that was kind of my suspicion. And also, I think when you have deities in a fantasy world that are more concretely real, it makes more sense to me, at least from the reader's perspective, that different cultures would all revere them or have sort of the same stories about them. Because if they are more concretely real, then it's going to be less open to interpretation.
Right.
You're not going to get, you know, well, our culture has one version and somebody else's culture has another version. Because if everybody saw and experienced the same event, they're all going to talk about it in the same way.
Right.
Understanding that you didn't want to get into the religious debate, which, you know, bravo. There's already enough going on in the story. You certainly don't need to get into that realm at all.
Right.
But you do have gods and goddesses. So how did you decide if there were going to be religious aspects, or was it just more of sort of a spiritual, sort of a naturalist practice and not so much of a codified, you know, priests and priestesses? For example, everybody worships in their own way.
So that is something that I made different between the different races. Some of the races have temples that worship a particular deity. So each of the deities have their own specific practice, if you will. Like one of the moon goddesses, there are three moon goddesses, which are the daughters of the main deities, right? So the blue Azria, she represents healing, and red Orwena, she's the, you know, patron goddess of war and warriors, and Hamra is lavender, and she presides over the births and deaths. And so they have different priestesses and temples that revere or worship each particular goddess. And so you have a group of healers, and you know that the healers in this world will all be working for Azria, and you know that the warriors all send their prayers to Orwena, and you know that the people that are, you know, presiding over deaths and births, their patron goddess is Hamra. And so each of the different cultures manages that a little bit differently. The Meccan are my favorite because they tend to work with Hamra, and I love the charnel houses and some of the amazing artwork that people have done over the centuries with bones. And I thought, oh, that's so cool. It's a little macabre, but it's cool. So I really want to have that element in there. So this particular group of people, that's what they do. They decorate with bones and they worship the bones, and they, you know, as opposed to some of the other cultures who are more into the warrior aspect or the healing aspect. So they all have the same experience, but they all, you know, deal with it in a different way, or have their cultures set up in a different way. So there's enough of a distinction for it to be realistic without having to say, oh, this goddess is this name here and this name here and this name here. And then you're wondering, well, wait a minute, who is this? Because again, our readers are not in my head. So I didn't want to make it too difficult.
That makes total sense. And it was easy to follow. A question that I had kind of getting into jumping from religion to magic is, there's this energy that's in the world, and do the people think that this is a divine energy, that it comes from the god and goddess, or is it just sort of an energy of the world? And is magic a separate thing, like in your mind, and maybe this is getting too in the weeds in world building, is it a separate thing from sort of the divine influence that the gods and goddesses can exert, that people can take crystals or staves or wands and they can actually harness this magic?
So that was my favorite part of the world building, was trying to portray a way in which people would recognize that magic is inside of them. That magic is inside of all of them. And it was really based on the Akashi or Chi idea of the world energy, the energy that flows through our bodies. It's kind of that metaphysical, you know, Eastern stuff that I've studied with Kung Fu that says, oh, we've got this energy, and wouldn't it be cool then to blow it up a little bit and make it do really cool things, right? So I took that basic idea. And so the people in this world, each area had their own sacred stone, you know, because I also love stones. And so I thought, okay, well, this will be my channel for this Arkezi energy. I'll take these stones and make each group, the stones have an elemental basis. So each group will have their own focus, right? So one group will have a fire stone, and so they wield fire, and the other group will have a water stone, and they can wield water. And yes, I did, you know, love the Avatar series as a kid. So you can see my influences. It's not hard, right? But I wanted there to be recognition that every one of them has this ability within them, but they've lost their confidence or their ability to make that connection because the deities have withdrawn themselves. And so most people have assumed, well, we're no longer magic. We're not worthy. We're just mundane. And so Cedrin's journey really helps the people of this world recognize that maybe there is more to us. Maybe there's more inside of us. And so they use these stones as a focus, but that's not necessarily the only way to do it.
Back to our writing life things. I do have a question. You mentioned that you have a pretty regimented routine and in how you're getting to write it out. Do you work with a writing group, or, you know, besides going to a conference, what is your community, or how do you then take a draft and polish it? Do you have first readers? Do you work with a writing group? What does that look like for you?
You know, initially I did join a writing group, and it was the most traumatic experience of my life. I had a couple of readers that were writers, and they just brutalized everything I did. And so it was conflicting information. One person loved this and the other person hated it. And the group as a whole had some really odd dynamics with these people that were brutal to everybody, not just me. They were very dominant. And I thought, you know, I think I'll just write in my little vacuum, and I read it to my kids, or, you know, I just trust myself. I just trust that if this is something that I would like to read, then it should be reasonably good. And because I've read thousands, right? Like all of us do. We read thousands and thousands of books. So I was super excited to get an editor and a publisher, because now I have professionals who are helping me, you know, find those inconsistencies and those little grammatical things. But thematically and plot-wise, my stories are pretty solid because I've done enough research, and I have, you know, I write with an outline. So I have my form or my pathway sort of labeled out for me. So I know where I'm headed, and I write chronologically. I write chapter one, and then I write chapter two, and then I write chapter three, which is, it limits me sometimes. Sometimes I have to go back, but that's, I don't play well in the sandbox with other children. I guess it really is. You know, I just didn't do well with that arena. And so I don't use it. I do the best I can, and then I hand it off to my editors, and they tell me to, you know, fix this, go back, start over, whatever they do. So I've been very fortunate.
How did you connect with your current publisher?
You know, Ascari was a great learning experience on how to self-publish or how not to self-publish, and all of the heavy duty work that's involved with self-publishing and being your own marketer and your own promoter, in addition to being the artist or the writer. So I really wanted some help on the second book. I wanted to find a publisher, and I looked for years looking for an agent, and I wasn't finding the right fit. And, you know, I know enough at 50 to realize that working with a publisher or an agent really is a lot like being married. And if it's not the right fit going in, it's not going to be a good partnership. So in all of this searching, I was down at a friend's house in Portland, and I was watching TV, and I happened to catch this evening show where this publisher was on talking about they had accepted, you know, Camilla Samshi's challenge to publish only female authors for 1 year. And I thought, well, I'm a female, and they focus in fantasy. And I thought, score, you know, these are the people for me. So I thought, okay, before I get too wound up in this, I think I'd like to just interview them, right? Is that approach. I'm not gonna pitch them. I'm not gonna send them anything. I'm gonna interview them first and see if I then want to pitch them. So I did. I called them and I said, hey, I'd like to take you guys out to lunch. Fortunately, they're in Oregon. It was only about a 5-hour drive for me, so it was worth it because I really wanted help. And I thought these guys really resonated with their approach on how the, you know, Ben Gorman is the co-owner and he is the coolest feminist person on the planet. He really wants to, you know, right the wrongs and fight the good fight. And that's great. And I resonated with that more than, are you going to sell books for me? Right. So that was great. And I met Ben and Paige for lunch. And by the end of the afternoon, I decided that I would go ahead and send them my prequel and my draft of Staff of Fire and Bone. And 6 agonizing months later, they decided that they loved them and they signed me. So that's because, again, you know, that's a lot to slog through. But that's how I found them. And I'm really, really happy because this isn't just a publisher and an artist. It's a family, and we all support each other and we all help each other, and all of the other writers, we all, you know, support each other and cross reference each other and help promote each other. And that feeling of community is exactly what I was looking for. And so I was grateful to the universe when I put it out, this is what I want. And I just happened to catch it on TV one night. I'm like, this is great. So I believe in this kinds of synchronicity things that happen.
Oh, I love that story so much. And to clarify it, it's Ben Gorman. Is it Paige Gorman?
Paige Gorman, his wife.
Paige Gorman of Not a Pipe Publishing are yes. Your publishers.
Yes.
And that was actually a second question I had, and that was a question for both of you. Is they Not a Pipe Publishing did accept the challenge to publish women for a year. Pardon me. And both of you, Molly, our illustrious host, and Nico, are both being published by them this year. What has that been like for both of you?
Yeah, I feel like I should have said at the beginning, you know, full disclosure, I'm also being published by Miko's publisher. And my experience has been so far, I totally agree with everything she says. You know, Ben and Paige are both out there fighting the good fight. And for me, I had been signed by Not a Pipe before they said that they were going to accept the Year of Publishing Only Women challenge. So when they came out and they were kind of talking about, you know, should we do this? Should we not? Of course, I was like, that would be awesome. But on the other hand, I was a little bit nervous because I thought, you know, well, there's always the fear that people are going to say, well, they're only publishing you because you're a woman and not because your work is good. I don't think that's the case with them at all. Ben and Paige are both people of just such integrity and character that I don't think they would ever compromise their level. They would never compromise their standards just to get things published. And I know from being at multiple writers' conferences, there is an ample number of women who are writing sci-fi and fantasy that you could do nothing but publish women for a year and still have incredibly high quality stuff being published. So for me, I'm not as far along as in the process as Miko. So I'll just let her tell you all about the wonders. Didn't your book get released just very recently at the end of January, Miko?
Yeah, January 30th. And this has been great. You know, and again, this SAMHSA challenge has really been a great vehicle for us to get more exposure because it is a really great idea. You know, this with all of the things going on in the world today with the no longer or not now or whatever the movement is, where
time's
women
up,
are actually,
time's up.
Yeah, time's up. I know, whatever it is, because yep. I don't watch TV, so I don't watch the news. but that's really, it's time for everybody to be who they are and to recognize their own value. But women as a group seem to have been suppressed longer in suffrage and all of that. So the idea that they are publishing only women for an entire year has really gotten us a lot of marketing and publicity because it's a great idea and it's timely. So the book released on the 30th, by the 31st, this story and links to my book and my picture and my book cover have gone all over the Northwest, all over the East Coast, and were picked up in like the Times of India with a readership of like 3 million. And I can tell you that was a squealing happy dance kind of thing because that's a big deal. You know, to have that many people looking at your publisher and saying, well, there are people in the world that are doing good works and fighting the good fight and, you know, presenting something out there that is a quality product by people who would normally not be recognized, you know, and they're also looking at in the future, you know, recognizing folks that are of color or in the LGBTQ community or what other marginalized or underrepresented folks there are not because single white men of, you know, Protestant persuasion are not awesome as well, and they are, but it's always been that way in this country, and there's such institutionalized benefits for a lot of folks that we don't even recognize it because we're cis white females or whatever. I think it's exciting to be part of a group that's doing this work in the world and getting recognition for it.
Definitely. It's been really exciting to hear about and watch how beautifully it coincides with all of the other movements that are happening right now. Because I know they started this a lot sooner than the Me Too and Time's Up and whatnot really coming to the forefront. So definitely a wave that's happening in the world. So awesome. Gosh, it has been super fun talking with you, but I think we probably ought to let you get back to your writing today. Before we go, though, we like to end every interview with a little spot of inspiration for our writers trying to master their craft. And I wonder if you have a last piece of wisdom you would like to leave our listeners with.
The best writing advice I ever got, and I love to share this because it's so much fun. I took a workshop with Stan Lee, the comic guru, and he said the coolest thing, and I'll try to paraphrase it eloquently, and I don't know if I can, but he said, you take your guy, right, your hero, and you make him want something really badly, but you make it impossible for him to get it, and the more he tries to get it, the more trouble he gets into, and the more he tries to get out of trouble, the deeper the pile of crap you dump him in. And that's what makes a story move forward, and I thought, that's really cool. I like that. I'll try to remember that, because we're all happy ever after kind of people, and we want to have this happy ending. But to make that ending valuable, you have to go through all this crap. And the harder you try and the further down you go. And I thought, that guy is genius, you know, just absolute genius. So I always share that with people because, and he was so much fun to listen to.
I bet. Gosh, that sounds like a lot of fun. All right. Well, Miko, how can our folks find you and your books?
So my books are online at the usual venues, Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, Powells.com. I am on Twitter at Azul Miko, or on Facebook, Miko Azul. I use my real name for everything, which may bite me in the butt at some point, but those are my main avenues. I do have a website, www.mikoazul.com. It's a WordPress blog. Clearly, I'm not very original. I just use my name for everything because it keeps it simple. So if you Google Miko Azul, you'll find lots of ways to find me.
That's probably the best way to do that, so people know how to find you easily.
Yeah.
All right. Miko, thank you so much. Congratulations on your book. It's so exciting that you've just published, and it's been so fun talking to you.
Well, thank you all. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I'll look forward to seeing more from you guys in the future.
Thanks, Miko.